And welcome to the Danger Zone. I am your host, Jim Tu, here at the SantaCruzVoice.com and now KSCO. So thank you very much for that. And let's see here. Today is Good Friday. And there is the old stack of stuff here. But one of the things I missed, I believe, was before we did the last show, was the No Kings protest. And, you know, so I have some sound bites here. Let's see if we can find them all here. This is from a gal named Christy Lee, L-E-I-G-H. And I think she interviewed just a couple people at the No Kings rally in Austin, Texas, or near Austin, Texas. And I believe, you know, this Ms. Lee probably caught the prototypical progressive who was attending the No Kings protest, as opposed to, you know, just interviewing the people who are on the dumb end of the scale or whatever. So let's see. I mean, she basically asked, you know, why are you protesting and stuff like that? So let's hear let's hear some of the results that she got. Okay.
What do you make of the fact that he was democratically elected, even won the popular vote? How does that make him a king?
It doesn't make him a king. It makes him a president, not a king.
Well, this is called No Kings. So what does that mean to you?
It means we got to get rid of him. He's not a king.
All right. So I think if you're a Trump supporter, you probably would agree with this guy that Trump is not a king. But, you know, so, you know, Ms. Lee, I think, does ask some fair follow-up questions. There are examples of unfair questions that you would ask somebody, like, when did you stop beating your wife? But, you know, she doesn't ask unfair questions, given, you know, why people are at the No Kings protest, and the answers that these protesters are giving. Let's see here.
It's a democratic process, and we've gone that route with him. Now, if he's acted like a king.
Can you give me a specific example?
Specific example? Well, there's a million of them all put together. There's no one example. It's exactly.
Just one or two?
It's more than one or two.
No, can you give me one or two examples?
Not off the top of my head.
There's so many, he couldn't give any examples off the top of his head. And I think that's pretty indicative of how, or of what a typical progressive person who hates Trump would give. But, you know, we shall see. Tell you what, when I'm on Flight 1080 on Tuesday, let's see if we can get some people who can give more concrete examples of Trump acting like a king.
I mean, I can, I guess. I'm just in loss of thought here.
You know, it's like when the hard drive on your computer just keeps spinning, or when you're asking the computer to do a very intensive CPU intensive function, you get that little hourglass on the screen flipping back and forth, or little clock ticking or wheels twicking. I think that's what's going through this guy's mind.
There's a lot of things.
Okay.
I can't really.
Okay, well, thank you.
Okay.
I know what Biden did. I don't agree with all of it, but this is way worse than what any other president
what makes
has
it
done
worse
in this country. You can't see that? I don't have anything more to say if you don't know.
Well, gee, I guess, people who support Trump aren't necessarily mind readers of people who don't like Trump. You know, again, certain things, I guess, to some people should be fairly obvious in their minds, right? But I don't think it's so obvious that you can't articulate the obvious. But yeah, that's, could be me.
What makes President Trump a king?
Himself.
What specific policies or actions?
Oh, everything that he does. The man's a fascist.
Can you give me an example?
Oh boy, of everything that he does. I mean, he just tries to put his name on everything.
What?
Okay. Is putting your name on everything, I don't know if that's necessarily the case, but I know he likes to put his name on a lot of stuff. But does that make you a fascist or a king? You know, I mean, I don't know. Certain kings are more modest, but, you know, I mean, if that's the worst that you could say of Trump, you know, we're actually doing pretty good. He has a big ego. Okay. That does not necessarily put people in prison unjustly or cause starvation or mass tumult, but go figure.
Specific action or policy is the Trump administration acting like a king. He wants to be a dictator. He loves.
What does that even mean? But okay.
Loves dictators. He wants to be a dictator. And didn't he just remove a dictator from Venezuela? He went in and stole them. So he was not a dictator in Venezuela? He was. So
again, you just the circular. This goes on for at least a full over 5 minutes of this kind of stuff. But you know, I think that might be indicative of the representative sample of how a lot of people who don't like Donald Trump are thinking on the No Kings protest. This is from, this next clip is from a No Kings protest in London, where an Iranian woman is confronting one of the No Kings protesters, another woman, and basically saying, you know, talking about the bombing of Iran, and the Iranian woman is an Iranian citizen, she is in London now, and she's a journalist, and she has friends and contacts, and she just basically just rolls this particular protester. Let's play that.
She's right. Iranians are asking for the bombs. Oh no, they are. I'm a journalist. I'm in contact with Iranian youth who are asking to be bombed. And you are standing here supporting a terrorist regime. What are you doing supporting a terrorist regime? Why are you supporting a terrorist regime? I understand bombing is bad. Convince me of what? Of rape? Of women not having no rights? I'm Iranian. I've been imprisoned by that regime. This has got nothing to do with Palestine. This is about a terrorist regime in my country. I can't even go to see my father's grave. I left as a refugee. You should think about it.
Yeah, I mean, the woman's, the No Kings protester's response is definitely muted, but you could tell she's not having any substantive responses to the main Iranian woman's points of things. She kind of deflects about Gaza or you know, just everyone's bad. But no, I mean, and then of course this is from the New York City No Kings protest, where a bunch of protesters at the No Kings protest, I think, let the mask slip.
Revolution. There is only one solution.
Communist revolution.
Communist revolution.
There is only one solution.
Yep. So did you hear that? This is at the New York City No Kings protest last Saturday. There is only one solution, communist revolution. Yeah. Yeah. That is, I think, where if you dig deep enough, you know, past the layers of whatever it is they're protesting, be it the immigration policies, be it Trump bombing Iran, even the White House ballroom, there's only one solution. They're communists at heart. And, you know, a lot of progressives will say, well, I'm not a communist. It's like, yeah, well, you're just going along for the ride. You're a useful stooge. You know, I mean, because as you make government, you know, if you're a frog, the proverbial frog in the pot, if you put it all the way up on boil, the frog's going to jump out, right? You gradually warm it up. Eventually, you know, the frog will just not notice it and then just figure it's normal. And then eventually you boil the frog. And the progressives are ignoring the fact that, yeah, you know, the heat's being slowly turned up. But it's interesting because all three of these examples basically show, at least two of the three examples show, they when you ask them a straightforward question, which are, I think, fair questions, they really can't give you an answer. There's a deflection, or there's just, you know, conclusory statements of, oh, everything's bad, you know, right? What makes Trump a dictator? You notice they didn't provide anything other than he wants to name a whole bunch of stuff after himself, which I don't necessarily think that makes you a dictator. It makes you maybe a little bit of an egoist, but I mean, even then, right? But anyways, so on to the stack of stuff, I guess. As of now, I think an F-15 a Strike Eagle was shot down over southern Iran, and an A-10 Warthog was also shot down in the same region. The pilot of the A-10 was recovered, is in good shape. One of the two crew members of the F-15 has been recovered, at least to my knowledge, and they're still looking for the other one. The Iranian government originally claimed that they had captured the pilots, and then they played local footage of from state media saying there's a reward for the pilot. So just goes to show you how credible the Iranian regime is. So, but anyways, and let's see here. We have this story from Jewish World Review from Richard Lowry, The Coming Arab Pylon. And this, I think, is a story, a column that brings some insights that would refute that the America is just doing the bidding of the evil Jews in Israel. Let's see. This is April 1st. It's not just Israel. One of the most convincing arguments of opponents of the Iran war was that the conflict initiated by the Jewish state for its own benefit, and the United States is just going along for the ride. This view not only discounts the U.S. interest in defanging Iran, but neglects the fact that other countries in the region besides Israel and Iran, and that they too have had a stake in the outcome of this war. The so-called Gulf Cooperation Council states, Bahrain, Kuwait, Oman, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates have the misfortune of being located just across the Persian Gulf from Iran, putting them on the front line of the war. A key element of Iran's strategy has been to impose economic pain on these states to force them to press the United States to stay its hand. For all that, effective closure of the Strait of Hormuz is indirectly harming the United States by driving up the global price of crude and other materials. It has a direct blow on Gulf states. The Saudis, Kuwaitis, and Emiratis send the majority of their oil through the waterway. The Iranians have struck the Gulf states with missiles and drones by the thousands. The ongoing blitz has damaged energy infrastructure, destroying a reputation of Gulf states as an oasis of calm and economic development in an otherwise turbulent region. There's no insurance policy against having a fanatic millenarian as a state neighbor. And nothing quite concentrates the mind like unprovoked drone attack on one of your luxury hotels or your airports, oil fields, and data centers. Iran likes to pretend that it was only striking military infrastructure, but that's absurd. As long as Iran is run on this basis, on its current basis, is grave danger to these countries, which prior wars tried to keep heads down or even get closer to Iran as a way to mitigate the conflict. A view looking north of showing the strait, which connects the Gulf of Oman with the Persian Gulf and the Zargos Mountains and the Qashem Islands in the background, areas of Oman, Muscat, and Erebus in the background. So I think what it means is what he's pointing out in general, I think, is that these Gulf states quietly and behind the scenes, per numerous reports, are pushing Trump to basically get regime change. Now, I don't know if Trump's going to get regime change or is going to push regime change to achieve regime change, because that's not one of the stated goals of our military action in Iran. But the Gulf states, you know, they didn't participate in the attack on Iran, but Iran's attacking them and they're not having it. So at some point, you know, when the Gulf states are starting to cooperate with Israel and the United States to get stuff done, we'll see. Now, it's interesting. The Gulf states, these Gulf cooperation countries, were pushing for a UN resolution authorizing the use of military force to reopen the Strait of Hormuz. Now, granted, two members of the UN Security Council, Russia and China, have opposed this, and they have veto power, which is fine. But the interesting thing is France is also opposed to a resolution authorizing military force to reopen the strait. So know who your friends are, so to speak. Let's see here. Oh, yeah. Another thing is, you know, there is the 1,000 pounds of 60% enriched uranium that's out there. This is from Breitbart.com, which might indicate why Trump really didn't make a mention of the uranium as much on his speech on Wednesday. Israeli military analyst, U.S. bunker buster strike entombed Iran uranium deep underground, avoiding high-risk ground op. It's by Joshua Stein, March 31st. A recent massive U.S. strike near Iran's central city of Isfahan likely sought to render Tehran's remaining highly enriched uranium stockpile inaccessible by burying it deep underground, a strategy that could negate the need for prolonged and risky U.S. ground operation to extract the material, according to an Israeli military analyst writing on Ynet, Y-N-E-T, on Tuesday. Israeli military analyst Ron Ben Yishai, a veteran Yedoit Adrot correspondent and an Israeli prize recipient, sorry if I mispronounced these Hebrew names, assessed that the strike reflects a deliberate U.S. effort to neutralize Iran's enriched uranium stockpile by entombing it beneath rock, soil, and collapsed tunnel infrastructure rather than attempting to remove it by force. Ban Yishai began what was described as one of the central unresolved issues of the conflict: Iran's remaining stockpile of 440 kilograms, 970 pounds for us Americans, of uranium enriched to 60%, a material that could be further enriched for weapons-grade level within weeks and potentially yield enough fissile cores for up to 10 nuclear bombs. That stockpile, he wrote, remains a major concern for both Washington and Jerusalem. So I think the fact that if this is true, then maybe we're not going to get a ground operation, or boots on the ground, as they say, to recover the nuclear material. Now, we might get boots on the ground for other reasons, like maybe rescuing the missing pilot in the downed F-15E, but, you know, or they may actually, you know, plant themselves on the Iranian side of the Strait of Hormuz to make sure that no ships get shot up going through the Strait of Hormuz, or they may seize Karg Island. Who knows what's going on there, but, you know, the fact that if this is true, then we're not going to be sending ground troops to go all the way into the deep in the interior of Iran to recover 1,000 pounds of enriched uranium. That might be a good thing. I do remember one of the complaints, and on a surface level, this is somewhat valid, that, you know, Trump says one thing and then the next day he says something completely different, or, you know, various people of his administration say things that are not necessarily consistent with each other. And on some level, that is a fair criticism. But on the other hand, you notice there is no apparent tension. You don't see the visible tension between Trump and the members of his administrative team. Heck, even Pam Bondi or whatever the case that be, whatever, right? But you don't see any, defensiveness when various members of the Trump administration go on TV and they make statements. And this article from the Free Press by Eli Lake, March 30, might explain why. Donald Trump is waging psychological warfare. In his war on Iran, is the president a mad king or genius negotiator? Eli Lake offers a third explanation. Call it the fog of Trump. As the Iran war enters the fifth week, the American president is doing his best to confuse the enemy and the rest of the world. On Sunday, Donald Trump took to Truth Social to share his optimism about negotiations with a new and more reasonable regime to end our military operations in Iran. That said, Trump's post continued, if the talks do not end the threats of shipping across Strait of Hormuz, then America will start blowing up power plants, oil wells, and refineries on Karg Island. Right? So what is he, what Eli Lake, I think, is proposing is that, by saying different things, he's basically creating chaos, not on our side, but in the eyes of the Iranian regime, which I think is an interesting take. And if you remember his book, The Art of the Deal, in terms of, what he basically wrote, is that the basic oversimplified version of how he negotiates is he starts off with something that sounds crazy and ridiculous, and then eventually he'll bargain away to get the position that he wants. Sounds oversimplified, right? Sounds like, duh, isn't that what everybody does? But the difference, I think, for Trump is that he establishes credibility in the sense that he could do the crazy things that he's proposing, right? He's established a record that he's willing to throw down. And, the first, Operation Midnight Hammer, when he dropped all the bombs on the Iran's uranium enrichment facilities, right, several months ago, taking out the Houthis, bombing the Houthis to no end, taking out the president of Venezuela in one night. So he's established that he can do the apparently crazy thing that he threatens to do. That gives him the leverage, the credibility and leverage to negotiate. Because you just like threaten to do crazy things and you never follow up on it, or people don't believe that you can do it, they'll test the bluff. And also, you know, given that the Iranian regime, I think to most conventional wisdom, is in itself fractured, you know, saying different things or giving different signals to the fractured regime might give certain elements of the regime, you know, more leverage versus others, or create uncertainty over others. And, you know, he always does give it as a, oh, I'm hopeful for the best, but I'm ready for the worst. And I think that might be the wise ways of putting it. And of course, not just the regime, but also for our erstwhile allies, be it Israel, be it the Gulf states, be it the Europeans who seem to be misbehaving badly. So yeah, take that for, I mean, is it a genius strategy, or is it just really the sign of intellectual chaos and senility? Well, if it gets what we really want, which I'm assuming is Iran surrendering its nuclear weapons-making capabilities, reducing its production of ballistic missiles and drones, and supporting terrorists in other countries, right? Call it great strategery. If it doesn't, then okay, you know, we are where we are, and yeah, we'll figure it out. Now, I think it's time to shift gears here on my stack of stuff. Let's go to the state of California, or let's come back to America, as the case may be. I think the big story of the week, at least from my point of view, and as a Californian, is this cityjournal.org story by Christopher Rufo, Ryan Thorpe, Kenneth Shrupp, and Haley Strack. Gavin Newsom's Empire of Fraud. And I think it came out April 1st. Let's see. California has lost at least $180 billion to fraud, according to officials and experts. Let's start off at the beginning. California is a cash machine. The state collects some of the highest income, business, and fuel taxes, and now spends $300 billion per year. I didn't know the budget got to be that big. I remember when it broke $100 billion. I thought that was crazy under Jerry Brown. But anyway, everywhere you look, California seems to be falling apart. The roads are crumbling. Mismanaged wildfires have turned neighborhoods into ash. Drug addiction and homelessness have metastasized, turning parts of Los Angeles and San Francisco into no-go zones. And the cost of living crisis is pricing the middle-class taxpayers out of basic necessities like groceries and gas, even as the state spends billions on welfare programs that never seem to lift anyone out of poverty. Californians are beginning to ask, where is all the money going? On paper, it funds hospitals, schools, universities, et cetera, but beneath the surface, something else is happened that California Governor Gavin Newsom does not want you to see. Massive, systemic, brazen fraud. We conducted interviews of public officials, fraud experts, and political figures, reviewed hundreds of pages of government reports, audits, criminal indictments, and other public records in California fraud. From unemployment insurance to Medicaid to failed homeless initiatives and welfare programs, seemingly every state program is compromised by criminals. Everyone? Oh my gosh. The best estimates suggest that on the governor's watch, fraudsters, scammers, and organized crime rings have stolen at least $180 billion from taxpayers. Now, I don't think that's in a year. I don't think that's throughout the entirety of Gavin Newsom's almost eight years in office. I suspect it's since 2020. And the reason I say that is because the first example that he cites is the unemployment insurance during the pandemic, which is about 2020 for all you people who don't have recent memory and history. And they basically, we knew at least about a year in, and or by the end of 2020, that California had paid anywhere from $20 billion to $33 billion in fraudulent claims of unemployment insurance in 1 year, right? Or during the pandemic, right? And so, but they give more specific examples of this, right? So, the scams began almost immediately with criminals from around the world reportedly siphoning cash from the program. In one case, a Romanian-led fraud ring orchestrated $5 million in unemployment insurance scheme. Members allegedly recruited potential EDD benefit applicants through Facebook, then met them in parks throughout Southern California to complete the application process, according to the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District of California. There you go. Applicants paid a partial fee up front for assisting for fraudulent applications. Another fee for after applicants received EDD payments, Alva said. Many of the fraudsters wired the stolen funds to Romania. Oh, around September 2020, Fontrell Antonio Baines, a rapper from Memphis known as Nuke Bizzle, released a music video on YouTube entitled EDD. In the song, Baines bragged about ripping off the California's UI program. Quote, go to the bank with a stack of these, Baines rapped, holding up EDD envelopes. Another rapper can be heard saying, quote, you gotta sell cocaine, I just file a claim. I don't think that really rhymes, but I get the point. All told, Baines obtained more than $700,000 in stolen funds using preloaded EDD debit cards. Gotta love the debit cards. He pleaded guilty to federal charges. Nor were these isolated incidents. The member of the SFV Peckerwoods, I thought I would know the name, a California-based neo-Nazi gang, gotta love the naming here, allegedly ran an unemployment scam during the pandemic. So did Michael Thompson, a one-time leader of the Aryan Brotherhood, who was eventually convicted. California's prison population apparently got in on the action, too. You can be unemployed and be in prison? Oh, never mind. The EDD allegedly paid out hundreds of millions of dollars in fraudulent claims in prisoners' names, including those of at least 133 prisoners on death row. What would they spend the money on anyway? Oh, whatever. Remarkably, EDD not only failed to regularly cross-reference the unemployment payouts to the list of state prisoners, but it also had just two bureaucrats assigned manually to inspect reports of suspected fraud. State officials eventually admitted to having paid out approximately $20 billion in fraudulent claims during the pandemic and to making at least $55 billion in improper payments. Oh, man, that's a lot of money. Talcove claims these figures don't even tell the full story. The state lost $32.6 billion of taxpayer money to fraudulent applications, he said. California, at one point, you had more people applying for unemployment insurance benefits than you had people over the age of 18. Oh, that's scary. Let's see here. Let's see, what other example was there? Newsom came to power vowing to pursue guaranteed health care for Californians. Under his leadership, the state extended Medi-Cal coverage to illegal aliens. True. Covered sex change surgeries for Medi-Cal enrollees. Probably true. And offered gender-affirming care services to enrollees of all ages. Yeah, I believe that. Total budgeted Medi-Cal spending, which includes federal, state, and local contributions, has more than doubled on the governor's watch, rising from $93.5 billion the year he took office to $196.7 billion in the current annual budget. During the same period, California's resident population declined by 0.2%. There you go. Experts have long warned that Medi-Cal's vulnerabilities to fraud. The state auditor first designated Medi-Cal eligibility as a high risk in 2007 and has applied that label ever since. But the state government has made little progress in addressing what the auditor calls eligibility discrepancies that present substantial risk of serious financial detriment to the state. California's attorney general can see that Medi-Cal fraud could reach billions of dollars annually. Yep, and he's still suing Donald Trump for whatever reason. Let's see here. We have an example. Here's one. In some cases, prosecutors say it's precisely what happened. One instance, Richard Paul Randall, Kirolis, Mikhail, Patricia Anderson allegedly took advantage of Medi-Cal's loosened restrictions as part of a scheme to defraud taxpayers of more than $178 million. The conspirators allegedly used a business called Monte Vista Pharmacy to process fraudulent prescriptions. Randall and others allegedly laundered the proceeds through third parties to fund kickbacks to Anderson and obscure the operation from law enforcement, according to 2025 Justice Department press release. Mikhail had pled guilty to criminal charges in August 24, and Randall reportedly expected to do the same this year. In-home supportive services, a Medi-Cal sub-program, has also presented major fraud concerns. In 2009, former Governor Schwarzenegger estimated IHSS fraud could be as high as 25%. That same year, the Sacramento grand jury report in the county's IHSS program claimed IHSS fraud was reported to be more rampant and out of control. Yet, even in light of these worries, Newsom has dramatically increased the funding for IHSS. Between Newsom's first budget and his most recent proposal, the state legislative analyst estimates the total IHSS cost will have swollen by around 170%. That's close to tripling for you people in Capitola. Let's see here. With around $33.4 billion proposed for the next fiscal year, including $12.5 billion from the state. According to recent estimates, taxpayers are funding nearly 800,000 IHSS providers who offer caregiving, cooking, shopping, and cleaning laundry services to elderly and disabled people. Hey, if you're an adult ne'er-do-well who doesn't have a job, but you know your mom and dad are elderly or whatever, just sign up for this program and get paid to take care of them. You know, assuming you take care of them. If you don't, that might sound like real work. But still, yeah. Because apparently, or heck, you don't even have to, apparently you might not even have to take care of them. It's based on an honor system. So you could probably rip off the state for ridiculous amounts of money. So that's just the tip of the iceberg here, Ian, here in California. It might make Minnesota's, you know, leering center fraud and medical transport fraud look pale in comparison. Of course, we also have the bogus hospice care scam going on in Los Angeles County. So hopefully we'll get some of that. But, you know, hopefully Donald Trump will do something about it. Let's see here. Treasury unveiled this from Zero Hedge and Epoch Times. Treasury unveils whistleblower portal to combat transnational Medicare Medicaid fraud rings by Kimberly Hike of the Epoch Times, March 31st. Whistleblowers are encouraged to report abuse of Medicare, Medicaid, or other government health programs to the Department of Treasury, announced on March 30th, while warning that sophisticated fraud schemes are siphoning billions of them. An advisor of the Treasury detailed in which transnational criminal organizations working with domestic fraudsters and organized crime groups create health fake care providers, employ cover people to pose as owners who are not U.S. residents, and steal personal data of actual beneficiaries to submit false claims for care that were never provided or was not needed. Proceeds are then laundered through wire transfers, digital assets, and culpable bank co-conspirators before being transferred overseas. Oh my gosh, I think we have Scott Bessent talking about it here. Let's see if we can get that sound clip going here.
Cracking down on fraud. We know the vice president's been given that task, but now you say Uncle Sam needs you is how New York Post interpreted the interview you gave them yesterday. You're actually asking the American people, if you know of fraud that's going on and substantially, come forward, you'll be rewarded.
So Brian, President Trump started this early on in his second term. Vice President Vance has been given the task of accelerating this. And it's almost like a suitcase in an airport. If you see something, say something. The financial institutions, because of President Trump, Vice President Vance's leadership, and Treasury's actions, we have seen financial institutions now filing what we call suspicious activity reports, SARs. That's up 20%, because they are the front line in identifying financial fraud. When nonprofits, whether it's daycare centers, hospice care, when they start wiring big round numbers out, that's a problem. There are large multinational criminal organizations that are doing healthcare fraud. So we are all hands on deck, because this is money that is not going to where it's supposed to go, but more importantly, it's being stolen from the American taxpayer. We need to be a high trust society. We need to understand that this is where the money is going. And this administration, this could be hundreds of billions of dollars in recouped money. And again, the programs are supposed to go to those in need.
Cracking down. Yep. That's, I'm hoping we can find all the fraud, but I'll believe it when I see it. Apparently, there's a bounty. If you report fraud and they actually claw the money back, you might get up to 30% of the money back yourself as a reward. Up to 30%. Not necessarily 30%, but, we'll see. Hopefully that's enough of a incentive to out the fraudsters. Anyways, this is from the on to more interesting stuff in lovely California. People vote with their feet. And this is from the California Post, March 30th. Mass exodus of Los Angeles revealed in shocking new figures. This is by Zane Khan, March 30th. Tens of thousands of residents are fleeing Los Angeles County, raising fresh questions about the region's future as economic pressures mount. The region recorded its largest population drop of any in the nation between July 24 and July of 2025. According to newly released data estimates from the U.S. Census Bureau, the data published March 26 shows roughly 54,000 residents leaving the county during a one-year period. The losses mark a continuation of a steady slide of the nation's most populous county. Once home to more than 10 million people in 2020, Los Angeles' county's population has now dipped to just under 9.7 million people, KTLA reported. While the raw number of departures is eye-catching, experts say the broader trend may be even more concerning. Fewer people are coming in to replace those who leave. Neighboring regions appear to be benefiting. Riverside and San Bernardino counties together gained more than 21,000 residents over the same period, according to data, while Las Vegas metro area saw an influx of more than 20,000. So people are voting with their feet, because basically, you know, Los Angeles County, might have other cities besides Los Angeles. But the city of Los Angeles is a big chunk of Los Angeles County. And the fact that, you know, the people who run the city of Los Angeles have, you know, they've been really soft on crime. They've been hostile to business, which is in addition, increasing the cost of living, increasing the cost of doing business, has lowered the quality of life. All the indicators all going in the wrong direction. So people are voting with their feet, as the case may be. And even within California, right? They're getting the F out of Los Angeles and moving to San Bernardino and Riverside, which I believe is where Chad Bianco is the sheriff, but you know, whatever. And San Bernardino County, I think San Bernardino, or at least the city of San Bernardino, I'm not sure if this was county of San Bernardino. I think the city of San Bernardino went bankrupt recently, like a few years ago. This story might relate to one of the memes I hear from progressive politicians, that the poor and the middle class in red states pay more than those in blue states, as the case may be. No, they don't. They just pay a small percentage of the massive amount of taxes that blue states like California collect versus, you know, the red states that don't collect a massive amount of taxes relative to California. And therefore, you know, if you're not collecting a massive amount of taxes, then theoretically, you know, poor people could pay a higher percentage of the paltry amount of taxes that are paid, and still end up paying less than what they would pay in blue states. And this one has an interesting, so this is from californiapolicylab.org. This is from the University of California. This is a research institute, the University of California, Berkeley. This is a study priced out relocation amidst California's affordability crisis, March 30th, by Brett Fisher and Evan White. This is from the executive summary. The growing costs of living are squeezing California's pocketbooks and causing some households to consider relocating. Using unique data that anonymously tracks the same households over time from 2016 to 2025, this report examines how many Californians are moving, who is leaving the state, and where they're going, and what happens to their finances after they move. The findings suggest that affordability plays a major role in California's relocation decisions. Californians who leave move to much more affordable areas and see large increases in homeownership on average. At the same time, data shows how more people continue to leave the state than choose to move here, a gap that is reshaping California's population. Key findings. Californians are leaving the state for more affordable communities and improving their financial condition. On average, movers relocate to neighborhoods where monthly housing costs are $672 less. After 7 years, they are 48% more likely to own a home. People moving out of California increasingly come from higher income neighborhoods and appear financially weaker than their neighbors. The share of exits from higher income neighborhoods rose 19% in the last decade. Those who leave have 5,000 more in student debt on average, and credit scores were 17 points lower than their neighbors. Let's see here. So what basically it's pointing out is that, yeah, you not just housing costs, but the income, you know, your expenses when you leave, of Californians who leave the state, go down dramatically relative to their income. So what does that mean? That means your income, you know, your net income, that's your income after all your expenses, actually goes up. You have more left over. So for those who think that, oh, no, the middle class pay more in taxes and stuff. No, because if it was true that the middle class and poor, you know, the people who leave California end up paying more in taxes or paying more out of pocket for stuff, they wouldn't leave in the first place. Or, you know, the first few people might leave, but then they come back and tell all their friends, it ain't worth it. But no, they are paying less. Now, granted, when they move to other states, they are paying less in taxes. They have more left over to save. But what they do pay in taxes might be a bigger percentage of that state's income tax revenue than their share of what they paid in California. But hey, they're still, from their point of view, they're paying less. And that's all that really matters, at least from their perspective, right? Yeah. Back to the bang for the buck. California, I think, might have the highest gas taxes in the country. Could be wrong, but but someone fact check me on that. Anyways, this is from the CaliforniaGlobe.com. Report, California roads and highways rank second worst in the nation. This is by Katie Grimes, March 29. A new study finds California has the second worst roads in America, ahead of only Alaska. I can validate this, having traveled 600 miles by car in California on Interstate 5, Highway 101, and State Route 152, and many local boulevards, thoroughfares, and roads in between. Yeah, I've done that ride. It's pretty bumpy. Californians pay the highest gas taxes in the country, yet are forced to drive over deep potholes, deteriorating highways, crumbling shoulders, and bumpy surfaces, damaged roads, patchwork fixes, uneven pavement, and deeply cracked asphalt. California's government is clearly broken, but so are our expensive tires, along with our bank accounts. Quote, California's highway system now ranks 49th out of 50 states in overall condition and cost effectiveness. Reason Foundation's 29th annual highway report finds. Barack Fiegelbaum, senior managing director of the transportation policy at the Reason Foundation and lead author of the report detailed in the Orange County Register. Only Alaska, which faces harsh winters and many geographic challenges that drive up costs, ranks worse overall, unquote. California has no excuse. Transportation funds have been borrowed for decades by the governor and legislature and reassigned to the general fund. No kidding. Rather than used to repair and improve the state's highways, roads, and infrastructures. Quote, given the money California generates from drivers, it should have better road system and a highway system, Fiegelbaum said. Quote, the legislative analyst office found the state's sources for transportation funding, primarily fuel taxes and vehicle fees, brought over $14 billion in 2023-2024. Yet, California's urban arterial road pavement condition is 50th, the worst in the nation. Not much better as the state's urban interstate pavement condition ranks 48th out of 50 states. California also ranks 47th in rural interstate pavement condition and 39th in rural arterial road condition. Since 2018, we've been told that California spent $843 annually on vehicle repairs caused by poor road conditions. I think that's on average. It's as if no one wants to report the real cost in 2026. Whatever it is higher than the national average. Yeah, it sounds about right. And let's see here. So yeah, you know, we're not getting the bang for the buck. And of course, maybe there's an element of fraud there too. I don't know if the federal government will sick old Sean Duffy to our state to investigate potential road construction fraud. He's probably got his hands full investigating California giving driver's licenses to illegal aliens who can't read our signs. But anyways, read our roads. Well, anyway, but that's besides the point. This is from Zero Hedge. The assisted suicide of lofty state and local taxes. So it's not just a California thing. Authored by Rob Arnault of Real Clear Politics, March 30th. We got the government we chose to elect, hence the government we deserve. Voting for ever higher punitive taxes on the rich is arguably the worst, arguably a form of civic suicide. Consider a wealthy New Yorker can get a raise for almost 40% just by moving. That's right. If moving estimate eliminates a 14.8% top state and local tax rate, our top tier taxpayer gets a 36% raise, not a 14.8% raise by a leaving. That's doubtful if any city or state leaders have done this math, but it's shocking. Now, what he's basically doing is he basically takes a high income New Yorker and, you know, just takes off whatever they have to pay in federal income taxes, which I think is about, what was the top income tax rate, federal income tax rate? I think it's like over 43%. All right. So, right. And then just figures, okay, on top of that, if you're a New Yorker, you pay the 43% top marginal rate of 43% to the IRS. Then you throw on top of it the 15% of that you pay the state of New York and the city. And then that's your take home pay, right? But if you move to Florida, you don't pay that state and local tax of 15%. You still pay the 40% you owe Uncle Sugar, but you know, 14% of 60% can constitute a 40% raise. Do the math. So that's a that 15% adds up, especially if you make a lot of money. But anyways, and most people, you think, well, you know, if you're rich, you can save everything. And I think most people realize people, even rich people, live up to their income, so to speak. They may leave something for savings, but, you know, they're not saving like half their income. At least, I don't know. Now, New York is having this problem too, so not just California. Major Wall Street powerhouse weighs Southern move as Mamdani-led tax threat swirl, New York Post. March 29, Craig McCarthy, Haley Brown. Major Wall Street powerhouse is weighing a Southern escape. New York City's new mayor talks about soaking big business with taxes, according to a new report published Sunday. Apollo Global Management, a $900 billion asset manager, is plotting a second U.S. headquarters in Sunbelt as Mayor Zohan Mamdani pushes tax hikes on deep-pocketed corporations, according to a new report by the Financial Times. Steve Fulop, president and CEO of Partnership New York City, a business lobby group, framed the Apollo move as a natural reaction to the increasingly unfriendly business climate in the Big Apple. The reality is you can't propose budget after budget that vilifies employees and then be surprised when they decide to move somewhere else. Yeah, that's probably why. I think old Jamie Dimon was commenting on this. And, you know, let's see what old Jamie Dimon of, I forget what he is. He's a big banker dude. I forget what bank he's from, but let's play it.
I tell people everyone's got to compete, including cities. And for a city to compete, of course, it's quality of life, it's your subways, it's your hospitals, but it's also individual taxes, estate taxes, corporate taxes, and it drives people out. So all you have to do is look at California versus Nevada, you know, New York versus Florida, and there's a huge exodus taking place. It's not good for the city, and people just make a mistake, I'll just tax these people, but that's the outcome. And very often people think they're being moral by doing that, but they're not. What they're doing is they're hurting your own city, and, you know, unfortunately, people vote with their feet.
You know, Jason, I think we get the...
Yeah, people vote with their feet, and they are moving away from blue states that have high taxes and regulation and moving to mostly red states, which have lower taxes and less regulation, or purple states next to blue states, which, relatively speaking, have lower taxes and less regulation. But yeah, let's go with that. But, so also on the, this is from Yahoo Finance. Apparently, SpaceX confidentially files to public, seeking $2 trillion valuation of Monster IPO. I got this from Yahoo Finance, dated April 3rd by Pras Subrahmanyan. Sorry about that, Pras. SpaceX officially kicked off its IPO process, resulting in the biggest public offering ever, comes as other rivals move in the satellite connectivity space, one of SpaceX's bigger businesses. The reusable rocket and space exploration company confidentially filed for an IPO with the SEC. Bloomberg News reported Wednesday. The details won't be available until closer to its official listing. The information and Bloomberg reported earlier that the SpaceX was expected to raise up to $75 billion in offering. Though SpaceX is most recently valued at $1.25 trillion, Reuters reported late Thursday that the company is seeking a valuation of $1.8 trillion, easily topping companies like CEO Elon Musk's Tesla. SpaceX won't decide the actual size of the offering evaluation until a few weeks before the IPO, with the company targeting a June listing. Bloomberg has also reported the company is considering a dual-class share structure in the listing that will potentially give insiders like Musk extra voting power. Now, my communist or progressive friends are like, well, that, you know, would be upset that theoretically that could make Elon Musk a trillionaire, the first one in history. And, oh, it's too much money to have. But, you know, the thing is, he built it. He created SpaceX. Now, he had a lot of help, but, you know, he was the guy that organized everything, got all the pieces together, and did all the hard work. Other people worked hard. Yeah. But, so the fact that he didn't take it, that's the thing. I think most progressives think that wealth is something that you take from other people. And that's not necessarily the case. It can be created too by building a better mousetrap, or so to speak. And I think that's what he's done. He has built the wealth. So, anyways, more power to Elon Musk if he can do it. We're at the end of the show. So, everybody have a great Easter. Happy Good Friday. I've been Jim Too. This has been The Danger Zone and at the Santa Cruz Voice and KSCO.com. Everybody, see you next week.